I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's September 14th, and we have a lot to talk about. And before we get into today's episode, I want to remind you that in just 2 days, on Thursday, September 16th, I'm launching the first episode of a special 8-episode podcast series titled The MS Caregiver Conundrum. I think most of you know that I spent more than 20 years as a caregiver for my wife, Jean, who lived with progressive MS. So this is a podcast series that I've always wanted to produce. This podcast is going to be a little different than Real Talk MS. You'll meet some amazing MS caregivers, some who are caring for a partner, some who are caring for a child, some who are caring for a parent with MS. And you'll also learn about some of the challenges that MS caregivers face. You'll hear about amazing resources for MS caregivers. And because it's me and I'm an MS activist, you'll even hear about the public policy issues that impact caregivers, as well as the state and federal legislation designed to support MS caregivers. As I hope you've come to expect on Real Talk MS, you'll hear all of this directly from the experts. Our former First Lady, Rosalynn Carter, said that there were only 4 kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need a caregiver. So if you happen to see yourself in one of these 4 groups, I hope you'll check out this limited podcast series beginning this Thursday. You can find the MS Caregiver Conundrum at mscaregiverconundrum.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Today's entire episode of Real Talk MS is devoted to talking about employment and MS. For so many reasons in our society, having a job matters. Most obviously, employment provides the economic resources that people need to more easily manage every other aspect of their lives. Perhaps less obviously, we tend to define ourselves through our work. And without work, we not only face potential economic hardship, we sometimes lose that inner sense of purpose or identity, of understanding who we are. The majority of people diagnosed with MS are diagnosed between the ages of 20 and 45, and when you think about it, these are the years when you're often focused on building a career and increasing your earning power. And reflective of the vastly different ways that MS can impact an individual, when it comes to employment, people living with MS make vastly different choices. Some people with MS continue working years after they've been diagnosed. Others leave the workforce within just a few years of being diagnosed, and many people living with MS leave the workforce prematurely because they aren't aware of all of their employment-related options. Like so many other aspects of living with multiple sclerosis, managing your employment requires a strategy. I'm joined today by employment and disability expert Dr. Philip Rumrill to talk about the many aspects of employment that people living with MS need to know about. Dr. Rumrill is a nationally certified rehabilitation counselor and the director of research and training at the University of Kentucky Human Development Institute. For many years, he served as director of the Multiple Sclerosis Employment Assistance Service, which provided vocational services and support to people living with MS across the United States. Dr. Rumrill has authored and co-authored more than 150 professional journal articles, 40 book chapters, and 6 books, including Employment Issues and Multiple Sclerosis, and Multiple Sclerosis, A Guide for Rehabilitation and Healthcare Professionals. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Philip Rumrill. Living with MS means learning to be flexible. Your particular MS symptoms may require you to redefine or rearrange certain aspects of your life, and some of the biggest challenges you may face could be at work. But meeting those challenges head on is such an important part of successfully managing MS and continuing your work life. Joining me to talk about MS and employment is Dr. Philip Rumrell, a professor in the Department of Early Childhood Special Education and Counselor Education at the University of Kentucky. Dr. Rumrell also serves as Director of Research and Training at the University of Kentucky Human Development Institute. For many years, Dr. Rumrell served as Director of the Multiple Sclerosis Employment Assistance Service, which provided vocational services and support to people living with MS across the United States. Dr. Rumrell is a nationally certified rehabilitation counselor and has published on the psychosocial and vocational implications of MS, including employment issues in multiple sclerosis and Multiple Sclerosis, a guide for rehabilitation and healthcare professionals. Dr. Rumrell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
Being employed in a rewarding and fulfilling job is important for so many reasons. And one of the most difficult truths about living with MS is that it can affect our ability to continue to work. Dr. Rumrell, can you talk about why someone's employment status is so important and how it impacts their overall well-being?
Our employment status is so important because in virtually every society of the world, we define who we are based on what we do. Certainly as adults, what we do is what we do for work. And we spend so much time, so much of our waking hours from the time we're 16 until age 65, 68, or 70, engaged in either training for work in our careers, doing the work, thinking about work, emailing about work, texting about work. And so it's the most time-consuming social role throughout people's lives. And we talk about work as a way to get paid and to have economic self-sufficiency. And that's certainly the case. But work is also our conduit to health insurance for many people, therefore to health care. We know that people who work have greater access to financial resources. They have higher levels of life satisfaction. They have more social capital, meaning friends and important social contacts. And of course, all the well-documented therapeutic benefits of working and the health consequences of working. People who work are simply healthier than those who don't. And for folks with MS, we know that MS can affect people's ability to work or the way that they go about working, but it doesn't affect their core personality characteristics. It doesn't affect their vocational interests. And so folks with MS, most of them want to continue in the same employment they had prior to the onset of MS. Or to find a job that's somewhat like what they were doing, you know, in the past. So it's an expression of personality, and people want to continue that regardless of disability. And I think those are the reasons, John, why it's such a big deal.
You and some of your colleagues have conducted studies looking at people living with MS and various aspects of employment. Can you share some of your findings with us?
Certainly. One of the things we find over and over and we're struck by is what an incredible labor resource that exists among people with MS. In America, 95% to 98% of people with MS have employment histories. About 60% of people with MS, and most of the studies that we've done, are college graduates. 75% to 80% are still working at the time of diagnosis. And yet, as time and the illness progress, we see a sharp drop-off in employment such that only about 40% of Americans with MS nationwide are currently employed for pay. We know that around 80% of folks with MS who disengage from the workforce leave their jobs voluntarily. So they make this choice of their own choosing. We also know that a vast majority of folks with MS who are unemployed feel they still have the ability to work. So they make that choice even before the MS condition itself has made it so they can't, you know, work any longer. And so they disengage from the workforce by all of these metrics, probably prematurely, based on their own interests, you know, and their own desires. And then they end up, you know, having to figure out how to restart their careers, which can certainly be done. But it's much easier, and it's much less stressful to help someone continue in the employment that they love before the illness manifested itself than it is to help them restart their careers altogether. So one of the things we find is that we've got a tremendously capable, qualified, productive group of workers who are disengaging from the workforce really in significant numbers, and then end up usually of their own choosing, and they end up regretting that decision and wanting to get back into the workforce. That's kind of the profile. And so we want to catch people as early in the disease process as we can to help them continue working as long as they wish to, so that that choice truly becomes the person's very own.
I think you just about suggest the most logical follow-on question to that. What resources are available to help someone who's living with MS remain in the workforce?
Well, three important ones I would point out, John, are the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. It's just an incredible resource. I think you have access to their actual website, and perhaps the listeners could get a hold of that. But you can Google the National MS Society, and you can sub-bar down to employment, and you can see all the employment-related resources. I'm sure it's nmss.org, John, I'm pretty sure. And then go down until you see employment and look at the wealth of online resources that that it has regarding employment of folks with MS. The other is the State Federal Vocational Rehabilitation, or VR, program, available in all 50 states and U.S. territories, provides free vocational and employment services for folks with MS, including assessments, training, job development, placement services to help you find a job, retention and on-the-job supports to help you keep the job, consultation regarding workplace accommodations, et cetera. It's a free resource as well, and our nation's oldest and largest employment program for people with disabilities. Thirdly, and there are many other great resources, but I always single out the Job Accommodation Network at West Virginia University, funded by the United States Department of Labor, an incredible free, toll-free, and web-based service to help people consider accommodations in the workplace that will help them continue in employment or start a new career. They've got specialty content on multiple sclerosis, and particularly the accommodations that people with MS have used to continue to succeed in their careers, and they've just done a great. You can index it by the condition you have, MS. You can index by the type of job you have, or by the particular issue you might be having, such as cognitive considerations. So those would be the three: the National MS Society, of course, the state VR program in each state, and the Job Accommodation Network, or JAN.
Knowing your rights can be an important aspect of maintaining your place in the workforce. So let's talk for a moment about the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA. Can you talk about what the ADA is all about, and specifically, why is it important for people with MS to understand this law?
Well, in terms of employment, the ADA provides people with disabilities, including MS, they provide them with the civil right not to be discriminated against on the basis of disability. So all personnel policies, everything in the human resource manual, all benefits, privileges, and opportunities pertaining to employment have to be of the same for people with disabilities as they are for workers without disabilities. This law took effect in 1990, signed into law by President George H.W. Bush. And at that time, it was the single most comprehensive civil rights law for people with disabilities in the history of the world. And it's remained so, and was amended and strengthened in a 2008 amendment signed by President George W. Bush, where people with MS were actually designated as presumptively protected under Title I of the ADA, under the ADA general, I should say. So if you have multiple sclerosis, you are protected under the ADA as a person with a disability, period. So it becomes very important, and so people with MS now have the civil right to fair treatment in the workplace. And that's everything from the way a job is posted to the interview procedure to questions that can be asked at a physical examination to the terms and conditions of employment to not being harassed or intimidated on the basis of your MS to how discipline is leveled, to how promotions are determined, to how salary raises, opportunities for training and advancement, opportunities to travel, to go to conferences, decisions about layoff or termination. People with disabilities have the right to have all of those decisions made fairly and based on their qualifications and experience, not on their disability status. So it's a huge deal. It also provides workers with disabilities with the civil right to reasonable accommodations in the workplace that the employer has to undertake to help the person to succeed in employment. And reasonable accommodations are not available to people without disabilities. This is a consideration for people with disabilities that helps to level the playing field, if you will. And so employers are required to provide a reasonable accommodation unless doing so would pose what is called an undue hardship, meaning that the accommodation would be either too costly, too disruptive, or would negatively affect other workers or customers. Excuse me. Undue hardships are determined on a case-by-case basis. They're first determined by the employer, but they are subject to appeal if the person who asked for an accommodation and didn't get one chose to appeal that decision. So a couple things we know about the accommodation process under Title I of the ADA in employment is that half of all accommodations that people with MS use cost less than $500 to implement, and 25% of those accommodations cost nothing at all, zero. So, and schedule modifications are the most common accommodation used by people with MS nationwide. All of these, John, are an outgrowth of our ADA and its subsequent amendments, which have really had a profound impact on opportunities and inclusion for people with disabilities and giving them the civil rights that other minorities were granted under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So it's a big deal, and it's a law that people who are protected by it, which is all people with MS, really should be familiar with. Google the ADA and read up on it. This is a law, and it's for you.
Can you give us some examples of reasonable accommodation for people with MS?
Yes, we've worked with folks a lot to help to implement accommodations. I'm thinking of something as simple as a small oscillating fan. We had a lady who was working in an assembly line position, and she had a hypersensitivity to heat, and she had a cooling vest, and there was air conditioning in the facility, but she still would get very warm at times. So we put a small fan. I think it was $9, and it rotated back and forth and helped to keep her cool. The same lady was having difficulty with fatigue, particularly when it was hot. And we recommended, and the employer installed a sort of 2/3 height stool, kind of like what you'd put at your kitchen counter, where she would not sit at the stool all the time. But while she was waiting for products to come down the assembly line, she could sit on the stool and take some of the pressure off her feet. And it really helped to, to combat fatigue. We had a school teacher who was working at a high school. And she was required to supervise assemblies in the gymnasium, which required her to walk up and down sometimes the risers, the bleachers in the auditorium. And it wasn't feasible for her to do that anymore. So the school district implemented an exchange of marginal duties of her job as a teacher, where instead of her supervising assemblies, she supervised an extra study hall, and the person who was doing the study hall would supervise the assembly. So they just switched duties. We had many, many occasions where folks with MS have been working full-time, like an 8-hour shift with a 30-minute lunch break, dealing with fatigue. And I don't know how many times we've recommended a longer lunch break, an hour and a half or 2 hours, where the person could either go out to his or her car or in an office and not necessarily go to sleep, but sometimes literally take a nap, just relax, do some meditation and relaxation biofeedback activities to combat MS-related fatigue. Also, renovations to restrooms in common areas is a very common accommodation for physical mobility issues. Accessible parking for people who may not be able to walk long distances or who may use motorized scooters, wheelchairs. Cognitive support technology in the form of memory enhancement and cognitive support applications or apps for an iPad or a smartphone. These are electronic prompts, memory aids, reminders of schedules to address both memory and executive functioning issues. All kinds of we've had folks who use a larger key keyboard if they've got fine motor difficulties or keyboards that are larger and easier to navigate. We've had people who use one hand has better fine motor skills than the other, so a keyboard that is operated by one hand, voice activation and artificial intelligence, where people can access the computer and their workstation by speaking commands. And of course, this is becoming much more common now with the advent and profusion of artificial intelligence that we all have in our homes, right, with Alexa and Siri and things like that. Those are a few, John. I could go on, but I won't. I give some of the examples. In the job accommodation network, John would have literally millions of these strategies and suggestions that they've offered over the years.
Who decides if a requested accommodation is quote unquote reasonable or not?
Well, the employer makes that initial decision. That's a great question and a great point, but that is subject to appeal if the person disagrees with that determination of an undue hardship. Because the employer is providing the accommodation, has to pay for it, the employer gets the first choice about whether it constitutes an undue hardship. But it's sometimes a source of disagreement, and people will sometimes complain and say, no, it's not an undue hardship. And what do you mean you guys can't afford a $50, you know, device or something like that? Having said that, I want to bring everybody back to that finding I mentioned where half of all accommodations cost less than $500 to implement. And in this economy where there's such a shortage of workers, and it looks like that's going to be continuing as we continue to reopen, and how hard employers are having to work to keep good workers, how about a very highly qualified, capable, productive worker with MS, well-trained, as I had mentioned before, do you think most employers would pay $500 for in order to help that person stay on the job and not have to replace him or her? They certainly would. And so we find employers not very often, John, getting bogged down in the cost of accommodation. They're usually amenable to those things, particularly if they can be convinced that it would enhance the person's productivity. Employers are pretty bottom line driven, and they want to avoid turnover because that's an incredibly expensive personnel cost, and they want to make sure the job can get done. And I think with COVID-19, we've learned it doesn't really matter where you do your work, what tools you use, what it looks like when you do your work, as long as you can do it. And there may be some long-term benefits of the pivoting we've had to do in COVID-19 for folks with MS and folks with other disabilities who are going to be able to do certain functions of their jobs through technology in creative ways we never had to consider until we had to get so creative because of the pandemic. I'm rambling a little bit, but I wanted to take this opportunity to talk about the ease, low cost, and utility of most accommodations.
And I'm glad that you did. You know, requesting reasonable accommodation, by definition, requires disclosing your MS diagnosis. And disclosing that diagnosis with an employer, that can be a very personal decision for some people, and it becomes a very challenging decision. What should someone living with MS consider in deciding whether they should disclose their diagnosis? And if they decide that they should, who do they disclose to and what information should be shared?
Well, yeah, that's a really important, it's a personal decision. The law never requires, the ADA doesn't require you to disclose that you have multiple sclerosis, only that you're a person with a disability. They can ask for documentation of your disability, but not of your diagnosis. So your employer, they don't have the right to know that you have MS, but they do have the right to know that you have a functional limitation, say with moving your the use of your right arm, if you're asking them for technology to accommodate it. Because of that, I encourage people when they do decide to disclose to talk about their condition in functional terms. I encourage people to only disclose as much as you have to get your needs met, whatever those might be. What is it they say in the business world, John? Once you've made the sale, stop talking, right? once the employer agrees to whatever it is, don't continue to add information to that. And because you're not required to give your diagnosis of MS, we usually encourage people to, when in doubt, maintain your right to privacy. Now, sometimes there are occasions when people say, you know, I want to get it all out on the table. I feel my employer is trustworthy. Those are some of the things you would take into account. But it is a matter of personal privacy, and it is your own choice. And you only need to disclose your disability status if and when you need an accommodation on the job. And we usually tell people that if your MS condition or symptoms are not obvious to others and you don't need accommodations for any of your effects of MS, there's usually no need to disclose your disability. If you're doing it and you don't need an accommodation, you're really making that disclosure as a courtesy. But some of the things you take into account are your own comfort level with disclosure. How much do you want to disclose? What is the purpose of the disclosure? Understanding that once you put that out there, you can never get your privacy back. So there's always a risk involved in disclosing. Strongly consider not disclosing any more than you have to in order to get the accommodation you need. If you can find another way to accommodate yourself at work that doesn't have to attribute it to your disability status, we usually encourage that. The employer will accommodate you informally without wanting a bunch of documentation. That's usually a good thing. And then what is the solution that you're looking for? Understanding the accommodations are going to help you most. But if you do disclose, disclosing that in functional terms and always accompanying it, never just tell them about your MS by itself. Give them the disclosure and then tell them what it is you want or need. Be very specific about that. And don't talk about it less in terms of how your MS or your condition prevents you from doing a function, but how well you'll be able to do the job with the accommodation. So framing it in a positive way that the accommodation will enhance your productivity seems to be the best way and the most important and the most effective way overall. And it sort of keeps the employer thinking about that bottom line, about how productive a worker you are, not getting into issues and speculations about your health or disability status. So those are the things I recommend. John, we could do a whole hour on disclosure too, of course, because there's all these nuances. Everyone has a unique and different kind of situation. The MS Society has a very good brochure on disclosure, which lays out a lot of these kinds of considerations. But it's a personal decision, and you need to be prepared. You need to do what makes you most comfortable in making that disclosure, if you decide to at all.
And who are you making this disclosure to? Is it your direct supervisor? Is it HR? Is it both, so they each hear it from you and there isn't anything lost in translation from one department to another? Who should you be talking to?
Yeah, the ADA does not specify that, but it's a very good question. If your workplace culture is such that the supervisor is always like, okay, I don't know about that, just go to HR. You know, so if you have to go to HR for like time off and vacation leave requests or to change your insurance, you know, then you probably go to HR because it becomes then a formal procedure. If the supervisor, and many employers this is true, they're the ones who are also handling all the management stuff, then you would go to the supervisor, you know, for that. So the ADA does not specify who you go to, and it doesn't require. The ADA allows employers to insist that you give it to them in writing, but the employer can take your word for it. You can do it verbally. And I usually suggest that people go only as far up the chain of command as they need to get their needs met. Less is more. Give them the information on the functional aspect, and that's important. Make it formal only if it's required. Document it only if they ask. And I'm not trying to sound suspicious or paranoid or anything like that. It's just really for folks' own protection. The best bet is probably to ask your immediate supervisor if someone were going, you know, you start with the supervisor if that person is accessible to you and you feel that person would be cooperative. You know, you would probably start with them unless there's a reason not to. But you can also go online and look at the policies at your place of employment about how, as a larger employer, they will have a guide for how do you go about requesting an accommodation? What do you need to do? and you might want to follow that that procedure. But there's a tendency to probably over-disclose rather than under-disclose. And I very rarely would talk with a person with MS who told me after the fact, you know, I wish I'd have told my employer more about my MS. I had a lot of people who would tell me they wish they'd told their employer less. And based on that, I say, keep it simple. Go only as far up as you have to. Start with the supervisor in an informal way, unless there's a good reason not to do that. That would be my general advice.
This issue of disclosure in the workplace is such a hot button issue for people who are affected by MS. I want to drill down to one particular detail of this sort of scenario, and that is disclosure with a prospective employer or at the time yeah. of employment. So someone is interviewing for a new job. Are they required to tell that potential employer, perhaps not their specific diagnosis, as you've already pointed out, but about any functional challenges yeah. that they may face?
Well, they are never required to at an interview. Let's just start there, okay? And you're only required to ever if you have a need for an accommodation. So if you're going to an interview and you have concluded that this job will not require accommodations for you to succeed in that job, in other words, there's nothing to ask the employer for, there's generally no need to disclose. Now, if your condition is obvious, like let's say you use a wheelchair for mobility, okay, you may wish to disclose. You say, I use this wheelchair for mobility, but I'm able to do all these functions of the job. I can demonstrate if you'd like. And in fact, it's important to know that if you have an obvious disability and the employer has reason to believe that you might need an accommodation or might have difficulty performing some aspect of the job, the employer can actually bring it up in the interview, even if you don't. So the employer can't ask if you have a disability like on application forms, but if you come in and it appears that your disability status is obvious, the employer could, for example, say, I see that you use a wheelchair and this job requires you to do some filing on a shelf that would be, you know, this high, 5 feet high. Can you show us how you would perform those functions? An employer has the right to be satisfied in an interview that you're able to do all the functions of the job, all the essential functions of the job. So, but if your condition is not evident and you don't have a need for accommodation, I would almost never disclose at an interview. If you might need an accommodation, I'd leave that open and I'd start talking about it, you know, at the point of hiring, because they cannot rescind the offer based on your accommodation need. If your condition is obvious and the employer might think that it would compromise your ability to do the job, sometimes you might want to disclose proactively. So they say, this is what the job requires, and it requires filing and that kind of thing. And you can say, well, you can see that I use a wheelchair for mobility. Here's how I would accommodate that function right here. You know, sometimes you want to do that to be proactive. Some people prefer to wait. But it is true that the employer is the only case when an employer can inquire about your disability status. Two conditions. One, the condition is obvious and would be reasonably obvious to others. And they have reason to believe that you might have difficulty doing that particular function. That's the only time they can inquire, but it is worth noting. So one of the things you think about in that initial disclosure at the interview is my condition evident to other people? And then the issue is, does it bring with it a need for accommodation? And those are the two things that you sort of have to put on a grid as you make the determination to disclose at an interview. But generally, only if you're sure you need an accommodation in an interview would I bring it up during that time. And this isn't to be suspicious either. It's simply to allow the interview to focus on your skills and abilities and not detract any attention away from things about your ability to do the job or your accommodation needs or whatever it might be. Let them hire you or not based on your performance in the interview, and then we can talk specifics. We can talk about start dates. We can talk about where your office would be, and we can talk about your accommodation needs. So it is always kind of it's a personal decision, and it's always a judgment call. But when in doubt, I prefer don't disclose and don't bring it up in an interview unless you're sure you need to. That's how I would probably summarize my advice on that.
So let's suppose someone took your advice and the interview went very, very well. They're offered a job, and then they're told all they need to do is pass the required physical exam. Now, they haven't brought up anything about MS at this point. What happens if they can't pass that physical exam?
If they can't pass the physical exam, the employer can, for any reason, the employer can rescind the offer. Okay? So the physical exam is important. Here's a couple caveats on the physical medical exam. One is it has to be an exam that everybody gets. So it has to be required for everyone. So if I come into office, I'm using a wheelchair, and they say, you have to take the physical, but nobody else does, right? It sounds ridiculous, but employers can't do that. It has to be an exam that everyone takes. The other thing, the other good news about this, John, is that the medical exam has to be job specific. So if I'm applying for that job as a filing clerk, and the most I would be required to lift in that job is a 2-pound file of papers, you can't ask me if I can lift 50 pounds over my head. So the employer may only inquire about your ability to do that particular job. But if there's a medical exam required and it is job specific and you go to it, you have to submit to it. You have to be truthful to the physician. The physician is not allowed to mention your diagnosis in the report. He or she can ask you, do you have any of these conditions? But the only thing they can certify in that medical exam is whether you're able to do the job. And when you go to the medical exam, what I encourage people to do, if you don't want to disclose your diagnosis at that point, you tell the physician, I don't want you telling them what I have diagnostically. You can tell them I can do this job or not. You're the expert on that, but I don't want them having my diagnostic information. All you do is tell them that I can do the job. So let me convince you that I can do the job, and then we can go from there. And if you're still not able to do it and you don't pass the medical exam in terms of that job, the employer can rescind the offer. So if you can't meet the medical requirements, the physical requirements of the job, the employer does not have to hire you. But I encourage people to instruct the physician, because often they don't know. I don't want you giving them my diagnosis if you don't want them to. And all I want you to say is that I can do the job. I'm fit to do this. And if the physician asks them questions about their abilities, you also have the right not to answer questions that aren't job specific. So if he says, can you lift 50 pounds? You can say, well, that does nothing to do with my job as a file clerk. So I don't want to answer that. You don't want to be uncooperative, but you also want to protect your rights. And not all physicians will know what the legal requirements are about medical examinations. They will tend to want to give your diagnostic information. They want to tend to find out what's wrong, you know, with your functioning. So the short answer is you have to take the physical. You have to be truthful. That's a requirement. If you don't pass it, you can't. They can choose not to hire you. But you can also advise the physician about how you want that to be presented. And they may not share your diagnostic information with the employer. It's unlawful to do that.
Dr. Philip Rumrill, thank you for all that you do to improve the work life of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
It was my pleasure, John. Thank you. Good luck, everyone. Stay safe and be well.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/211. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. Don't forget to check out my new 8-episode podcast series, The MS Caregiver Conundrum, beginning this Thursday, September 16th. You'll find The MS Caregiver Conundrum at mscaregiverconundrum.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. I hope you'll plan on giving it a listen. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.